The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
Our guest this week is Lord Andrew Adonis. From 1991 to 1996, he worked for the Financial Times as a journalist.
If I'm correct, I don't think you can say Lord Andrew Adonis. That's not the correct title. I think it's only if you're...
He answers this. This one answers to anything. He's formerly the son of a duke or a marquis or an earl, if you refer to him like that. But you know, I'm a man of the people, so I answer to anything.
Why are you wearing the big hat and the massive jumpers?
Oh, well, you haven't seen...
Why is there a horse in the corner?
Yeah, well, it's the ermine, which is, you know, I keep hanging up in the closet. That's it. But anyway, I'm very happy with just Andrew Adonis. I don't even need the Lord.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for the informality. That does not change the fact, however, that you worked as a journalist. You were director of the Number 10 Policy Unit. You've been a life peer since 2005. Education Minister, Transport Minister, Chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, winner of the European Railway Award for 2015, and most recently author with Will Hutton of Saving Britain, How We Must Change to Prosper in Europe. Welcome to Polling Politics.
Thank you. The only one of those that I really value, by the way, is the European Railway Award.
I can see you smiling. I went
to Brussels specially to get it, and I came back all in one evening by train.
Oh, so fantastic. Was there much competition? Were you up against some of the greats of European railway?
Only the people who take gold in the Olympics have to go through more than winning the European Railway Award. You have to travel on at least 90% of all Europe's railways in order to qualify. And then you have to do it again super quick. And this weekend I'm going to Ireland and doing Ireland's railways. That's to qualify for next year's award.
And did they promise to give it to you but then turned up late?
No, the Eurostar was there. It was fine. And it's hanging on my wall now.
Excellent. In terms of news, it's been quite a quiet week away from the world of Brexit, which obviously we'll come on to. But I was taken by none other than Melania Trump, of all people, attending a federal conference on cyberbullying to talk about how destructive social media can be. Andrew, you're an arch Remainer and indeed were described as an ermine-clad troll by an MP. And that was in person, I believe.
And he's supposed to be one of the pro-European ones. So can you imagine what it's like when I'm up against Nigel Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg?
This is what I was going to say.
The gloves really come off then.
Presumably you must have an awful lot of experience with the dark side of Twitter. What do you think of it as a force for debate in British politics?
Well, it's the way we do politics now, and it has two great virtues. The first is instant comment, and the second is it doesn't need to be mediated. In the old days, when you had to do press releases and it depended upon people picking them up and you had to phone them and all of that, effectively, you had a kind of media closed shop that meant you couldn't get your message across directly. Well, there's no closed shop now, you know, within seconds of your posting. Of course, the whole world can see it, and I think that's good. The bad side to it, I'll be quite frank, I think is the anonymous tweeting from people who are acting totally irresponsibly and, at the worst, very, very irresponsibly. I mean, threats and things of this kind, which, of course, couldn't conceivably happen if it wasn't anonymous and if it wasn't social media. So there are pluses and minuses, but overwhelmingly plus, in my view.
Do you think it's particularly difficult for people who take an active position on Brexit?
Well, Brexit really does stir up the emotions in good ways and bad ways. Good ways in that it's encouraging a huge participation in a big national debate, which is good, because one of my experiences of politics over the last 30 years is mass apathy. It's been, you know, remember, it was once said of Willie Whitelaw that he was sent out on behalf of the Conservatives to stir up apathy. Well, that's roughly the way elections were run until big issues started coming up. Well, they're big issues now. The bad side to it, which I am very worried about, which is part of what I was saying a moment ago about the trolls, is there's a lot of aggression out there, latent violence, and there's something about social media and particularly anonymity on social media that seems to allow people to do things which they wouldn't conceivably do if they had to come out in the open and justify them.
I know, I agree, and I do think that, especially for a political journalist as well, Twitter has kind of changed things and made actually our jobs quite a lot better. So I think quite a dull example would be probably PMQs of, you know, if you get a Twitter list of all the MPs and you're all by party, etc. Just reading a quick thing, you know, let's say what, you know, 20 MPs have said about PMQs, you kind of get a good sense of where the party is at, you know, how they feel about the leader, about PMQs, about stuff in general. So I do think it's really useful. But that being said, it's true that, you know, and I'm not even that high profile, but the amount of like abuse I've received over the past few years has been incredible. So I can't even imagine what it's like for other people. But also I do think that what worries me a bit is that there are so many arguments where each side clearly takes the other side's arguments in the worst possible faith. And so actually you see all these arguments, I see them on my timeline, where they're clearly talking past each other and kind of just, you know, using straw men and not actually having any sort of constructive debate. And I'm not sure how useful that is.
Well, the reason I do it all, until a year ago, I wasn't really doing much Twitter at all, is because this isn't just a refined debate which runs on Twitter and doesn't go beyond it. My profound view is that we're going to have a people's vote, a referendum on this big European issue, and it's going to be the biggest political battle in my lifetime. And what we're essentially at the moment is the phony war. What we're doing is the sides are rehearsing their arguments, they're starting to mobilise their forces. A lot of what you do on Twitter is an echo chamber, but that's none the worse for it if what you're trying to do is to get a very big echo, because you need all these people to be out campaigning when it comes to the real battle, which is going to be the referendum. So if it was just an end in itself, I don't think I would be spending the time I do on Twitter simply to give my views and to get a response. The reason why it matters is that the whole future of the country is literally at stake, because if we get this people's vote, and Joe, you're the pollster, so you can tell us what the prospect is, but if we get it, that is a massive political battle, and having people mobilised, and Twitter and social media is hugely important to mobilising them. You know, we're planning a massive march in London for the people's vote on the 20th of October, getting people mobilised to come to that. You know, I'd love to see a million people on the streets of London. That all takes big organisation, and social media is a big part of that.
The one thing I'd say, though, is that why didn't that, do you think, all happen before the, you know, before the original referendum? Like, I feel like there wasn't that level, actually, of mobilisation at the time on social media around the Remain campaign. Do you think it was just because there was a level of complacency?
Definitely. I mean, I made precisely one speech in the last referendum campaign. I'm not for a moment pretending that my making more speeches would have tilted the balance.
How many needed to make
Well, I think I probably needed to make about a million speeches. If each one of them converted one person, then we might have got a different referendum result. That was true across the piece. And unfortunately, it was particularly true of Labour people, because there was two things going on. The first was complacency, that we thought we were going to win it. The second thing, to be absolutely blunt, is not many of us felt much enthusiasm about going out there and supporting David Cameron. And I thought the referendum was unnecessary. I thought that he'd been hopeless in the whole way he'd conducted the renegotiations. I was very turned off by the way he was making the arguments. He never made pro-European arguments. He kept referring to it, you know, as this organisation, almost as if it was, you know, tongs at a distance. And I thought it would probably be carried, but the whole thing had been a pretty pitiful experience. But it was only after it had been lost that we realised how much was at stake.
We'll come back to Brexit in a moment, but just before that, we have the, well, I guess it's related, we have Dr. Liam Fox, International Trade Secretary, who is making an announcement about trade exports and how the UK can be an exporting superpower, in his words. He wants to increase exports from 30 to 35% of GDP. He's announced a whole load of initiatives that will help that. If you were Liam Fox, would you have resigned by now?
Do you know, I cannot conceive of the universe in which I would be Liam Fox. I mean, this it involves...
You're
not,
both doctors.
It involves... Yeah, we don't even deal in... I'm philosophy and his medicine, but I, to be frank, I'm not sure I would really want to take my innermost complaints to Liam. The truth of the matter is that he's on another planet. I mean, literally on another planet. What he is proposing to do is to wrench us out of the trading bloc, which accounts for 45% of our trade, and which then has trading agreements, because the EU has trading agreements with another 53 countries that account for another 15% of our trade. So we're in this Alice in Wonderland world where we trash nearly 60% of our trade. But we say that's all going to be fine, because Antarctica, the United States, China, other places which either we're not going to be able to get trading agreements with in short order. The idea we're going to get a trading agreement quickly with President Xi or with President Trump, of course, is for the birds, or are simply mythical, like Antarctica, that these are going to replace it. I mean, it is, frankly, it's another universe, and it's very hard to engage with something that is so metaphysical.
But I don't know, I'm going to be quite cynical here, I think, but I did kind of enjoy this story because it, Like, it smells so strongly of the Kenny Noon. Number 10 grid. It's mid-August.
It's the week before the bank holiday Monday. Yeah. Someone's got to go out there and talk about things.
But also, they normally kind of keep him hidden in the cupboard. Like, if you look at the news, like, Liam Fox is very rarely, like, the DIT is very, very rarely in the headlines. So I like the idea of kind of him knocking on the door of number 10 every week going, you know, can it be my week now? Can I do my thing? And finally, they're like, you know, Liam, you know, the best week famously for political news, in the middle of August, you're going to have the limelight. And he's like, finally.
This inevitably, of course, leads to a discussion, a wider discussion about Brexit and the whole issue. Andrew, just recently you were quoted as saying, if Labour becomes an accomplice to Brexit, it is finished. If people want Brexit, they will vote for the party that really believes in it, not the one that is being led to support it against its most profound convictions and misgivings. How do you think Labour could improve its position with regards to Brexit?
By having a policy. I mean, the big problem at the moment is Labour doesn't have a policy on Brexit. It's got a policy to defer having a policy, that we're going to have a policy when we see Mrs May's treaty or no treaty, and we apply the six tests. And by the way, can either of you name the six tests?
Nope.
If I do a quiz on the six tests?
Nope.
No.
I'm happy to admit,
Mark,
I do.
Luke, John, yeah, and Ringo, Paul.
Something like that. And then there's St John the Divine at the end, which of course is definitely Jeremy, because he has some saint-like qualities. But it's not good enough, in my view, when you're facing the biggest issue in politics, and actually this generation, to say that we will have a policy in somewhere between 3 and 6 months' time. Now, the overwhelming majority of Labour Party members, and indeed the overwhelming majority of Labour MPs, want to stay in the EU. Increasingly, they want a people's vote, because they recognise that there's only a democratic way of resolving this. We can't do it in any other way. If we had the leadership, I believe we'd be in that position now. Now, to be fair to Jeremy, he hasn't declared himself against what I've just said. He just hasn't declared himself in favour of it. But there is a limit to how long you can sit on the fence. You know, it was said of Sir John Simon, who was a prominent politician in the 1930s, that he had sat on the fence for so long that the iron had entered his soul. Well, I am trying to prevent Jeremy from succumbing to whatever is the disease that afflicts you when iron has entered the soul, and then you have to go to Dr. Liam Fox's surgery.
But then, so I do feel like there's a dynamic there that's quite interesting as well, where Corbyn partly won because, you know, his kind of diehard supporters said, we need to give power back to the Labour members. You know, it doesn't, like, it shouldn't be about the MPs and the councillors, etc. It should be about the members. You know, agree, disagree, that's besides the point. But then, so obviously, Corbyn got elected, and then, you know, as you said, Labour members do overwhelmingly support either no Brexit or, you know, the kind of like softest Brexit, etc., at least, you know, another vote. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, kind of completely ignoring the membership. And it's like, pick one side. I don't really care which one you pick at this stage, but, you know, either the membership has to matter, like people put right front and centre of Labour policy, or they don't. But you can't kind of walk that line. And
the truth of the matter is that Jeremy is finding it hard to make up his mind on Europe, because historically, of course, he was always anti-European and voted against all of the European treaties from entry in the 70s right through to the Lisbon Treaty under Tony Blair. But he does understand the arguments of Yanis Varoufakis and others who say that Europe is now a dangerous place, and that you absolutely don't want to be at the mercy of Trump and Xi and also the big international conglomerates, you know, the Amazons, the Facebooks and so on, who can only really be confronted at European level. So it's taking him time to make up his mind. Now, what I and others are trying to do is to persuade him that the only credible future for this country and for the left in this country, for progressives and for socialists in this country who want a fairer society and who want to see a democratic control of business and industry and not it running riot, is to stay in the European Union. And I think he's getting there. It's just, to be blunt, taking a bit longer than I would have liked.
You've articulated what you think should happen. What do you suspect will happen?
Hold on, let me wind back. Brexit will collapse. Let me be very clear about that. Brexit as a policy, that is wrenching the United Kingdom out of its trading bloc, is, as somebody put it recently, like trying to take the omelette out of an egg. I mean, that is what it is as a policy. The problem with Brexit, and I'm being extremely candid in the secrecy of this podcast, the problem with Brexit...
Don't worry, neither listener will say
it. The problem with it is that Brexit might collapse after we've left the European Union. The big issue in politics at the moment is whether we can stop Brexit happening or whether we have to go through the Brexit experience, including all of the dislocation and the political controversy that we're going to have, and then the desperate need to get close again again to the European Union, so to develop some kind of Norway-type arrangement, which then ends up taking us in again in 10 or 15 years' time, whether we have to go through that whole experience. Now, when I started out as a young academic, the first book I wrote was on the poll tax.
Was it with David Butler and Tony Travis?
It was.
Entitled Failure in
British
Government,
the
Politics
of
the Poll Tax.
You're well briefed, aren't you, Joe? I'm really impressed. Now, the really interesting thing about that is that the poll tax was never going to work. This was collecting £500 a head from people in Hackney. This was in the 1980s, many of whom didn't have any income. The amazing thing about the poll tax, though, is so efficient is the British state and so law-abiding are the British people that the government, the Thatcher government, did manage to introduce it, and it lasted 1 year, amazingly. And it did destroy all of the rating system, which was the system for funding local government before. My big fear about Brexit is not that it will work, because it won't work. We will end up back in the European Union within 20 years, or a situation very similar to Norway, so all but in the European Union. The big problem is we may have to go through the trauma of trashing our living standards and our international standing in order to understand that it's not going to work.
We touched on what went wrong last time around in the campaign. What do you think would have to happen differently if a people's vote, as is your wish, took place?
We've got to have the Labour Party at the front and centre of the campaign against a hard Tory Brexit. So that means that Jeremy absolutely has to be fronting this.
He'd need to bring his enthusiasm above 7 out of 10, do you think?
He'll need to, Fortunately, that's not difficult, because the referendum member will be on the terms of Brexit that Theresa May has negotiated. So all he needs to be is 10 out of 10 against hard Brexit a la Theresa May, not 7 out of 10 in favour of some mythical Brexit that doesn't exist. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to expose the lies. We know we cannot have the BBC saying, when people say £350 million a week for the NHS is going to flow from leaving the EU, saying, OK, that's one assertion. Would somebody like to come and give a different assertion? Which is what happened last time. We've got to have the reign of truth, which is part of what I'm seeking to establish at the moment. And the third thing is we need what I call the Tory wets, like Mr. Tugendhat, who has so generously decided to criticise me. The reason he criticised me is because I criticised him. I said that the Tory
wets...
As is
often the way on Twitter.
I'm afraid, is what happens. But you've got to understand how important this is. The Tory wets, who are the people in the 1980s, who keeled over and allowed Margaret Thatcher to destroy British industry and to turn us into two nations, they are exactly the same people. Rather, it's the sons of and daughters of those people who are now Tory MPs, and the Tory party, of course, is a hereditary party, so it's literally in many cases the sons and the daughters, who are now proposing to keel over and allow Brexit to happen on whatever terms Theresa May negotiates, because they don't want to disrupt their Tory social circles. And what we've all got to do is start calling that out and say that, you know, rather like when people were faced with the horrors of appeasement in 39 and 40, there are certain moments in the life of the nation where you have to stand on principle for the thing that really matters. And stopping Brexit is one of those moments.
But then, so what do you make of, because I feel like, and that's more in terms of parliamentary arithmetics, but for every sort of like Tory wet who might rebel against the party, there will be at least sort of like, you know, one Labour MP who's actually in a kind of, you know, traditional Labour heartland and is actually, you know, clearly quite Brexit friendly themselves. So how do you deal actually with, you know, with the Labour leavers, I guess, or at least the, you know, born again Labour leaver MPs?
Well, there's a huge difference in quantity here. There's a handful of Labour leavers. Probably if Jeremy moves and it becomes party policy to have a people's vote, I'd be surprised if you had more than three or four Labour MPs who voted against it. The big problem on the Tory side is that out of 317 Tory MPs, so far you've had no more than 20 who've been prepared to defy Theresa May and take a more pro-European stance. And we need far more than that to back up people's voters if it's going to happen. And the people like Tom Tugendhat, sorry to keep praying him an aid, but he sort of stands for, you know, because Tom's uncle was a European commissioner. I mean, we're talking about somebody who's, the idea that he is somehow intrinsically anti-European is for the birds. People like that have got to have the courage of their convictions, and they've got to vote for a people's vote. And if they start using all these weasel words about why they're not going to, I'm afraid that is just like the people who supported Chamberlain and appeasement in 1938, not because they believed in it, but because they wanted a quiet life.
No, I mean, I'm just going to disagree with you. I think if, even on the Labour side, if there's, you know, something about potential people's vote, I think more than three Labour MPs actually would vote against the idea. I feel like your arithmetic is being quite optimistic.
I'm one of nature's optimists. But what I would say is it's going to be, obviously I can't be certain, it'll be a small number. is the point. The overwhelming majority of Labour MPs would back a people's vote if it became the party policy. And the problem which we've got in the Conservatives is at the moment it's only a small number who will stand up for the proper interests of the country. And the great majority, I'm afraid, like lemmings, are walking over the edge of the cliff at the moment.
You've talked about support for people's vote in Parliament. There's also, of course, the issue of public support. And measuring that depends on precisely how you ask the question. A recent survey from my former colleagues at YouGov showed that 50% of people would be interested in a referendum in the event that negotiations broke down, 45% interested in backing a vote on the outcome, even if talks didn't break down. Over at Delta Poll, we have 46% of people supporting a second referendum in one form or another. What number does that have to be before you, as a strong supporter, become, shall we say, comfortable with it? Well, because it's clear from the data that things are moving in that direction. And if that continues with not long left, how high does it need to get?
Well, the higher the better. But the art of leadership, though, isn't just to look at polls. The art of leadership is to lead. My own view, and let's be clear, most people aren't going to form a view on whether they think Theresa May's deal is a good thing or a bad thing until they see it, or until they're actually asked to give their view. So all of these numbers at the moment are essentially fingers in the air. The reason why Parliament should vote for a people's vote is because Brexit is the wrong policy for the country. You know, could you imagine Churchill coming along in 1940 and saying, well, I'm not sure whether this is actually the moment to say that we need to stop appeasement and really go for it, because I've just looked at these polls and, you know, that appeasement, that was wildly popular 2 years ago, the polls still show it's got something like a 52 to 48 lead at the moment. That is not the art of leadership. The art of leadership is to say what you believe, argue it powerfully, particularly on something as big and important for the future of the country, and seek to win. Now, I'm not saying you can win, but on something as big and vital, where the interests at stake are so great, I don't think people should be making a decision if they're in Parliament just on the basis of opinion polls.
Are you concerned, though, about the backlash that that people have mentioned, the idea that this will lead to a rise of all sorts of things, actually?
The far right,
the populist right, the alt-right, etc., yeah, etc. UKIP will rise again if, as people say, the will of the people is ignored. That's how they would characterise
it. Well, we're by definition not ignoring the people, because it's the people who will take the decision. So it's very hard to argue there's going to be a massive popular backlash because the people are themselves asked to vote. It's like saying that there'll be a massive popular backlash because we have a general election, having only had a general election 3 or 4 years before. I'm afraid it's called democracy. We're a mature democracy, and we absolutely shouldn't be bullied, either as parliamentarians or as ordinary citizens, into not doing the right thing because we're being threatened by the far right.
I do think that actually if the options are, you know, sort of like very clear on like the deal and not just saying, you know, like let's just, you know, kind of like redo the referendum, it might help. But at the end of the day, I do think that if kind of, let's say, there's an option on the ballot saying, actually, you know, let's just give up and, you know, let's kind of like not do Brexit, I do actually worry that quite a lot of people will lose whatever little faith they have in Westminster. Well, you know, I disagree with the idea that, you know, all of the 52% were just disenfranchised people who kind of voted as, you know, a kind of outraged, like, you know, kind of at Westminster. But quite a lot of those people did, you know, like we know that people who didn't traditionally vote, like a lot of them did vote, you know, for Brexit and then actually didn't vote in 2017. So like those people exist, I think, in people in communities that are normally quite deprived and forgotten about, you know, left behind is the preferred phrase. So I'm not entirely sure what you'll say to those people.
Well, what you say to them is, we're now going to start dealing with the real issues that matter to you, the state of the NHS. Why is that we haven't got enough apprenticeships for young people? What we're going to do about the state of housing and the fact that there's, you know, massive undersupply of housing. We need to start talking about the real issues that matter to people. Because you see, what's happening on the right is that they're saying that there's this revolt against the elites. They are the elite, of course. I mean, the idea that Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nigel Farage, you know, Eton and Dulwich, respectively, are not the elite, this is farcical. But they're using it as an excuse not to deal with those big issues, which they don't want to deal with for ideological reasons. Jacob is perfectly open. What he wants is a smaller state.
And speaking of Jacob Rees-Mogg, Julian Dunkerton, one of the co-founders of Superdry, this week pledged £1 million to support a people's vote. And there was a backlash against that, with many people on the side of Brexit saying that they would now boycott Superdry. Will we ever see Jacob Rees-Mogg in a multi-zipped jacket with random Japanese writing on it ever again?
If anything depended upon going into ordinary retail establishments, if that was the threat of boycott which Jacob is going to regard as potent then, since I don't think he's ever been into any of those in his life. I don't think that's going to get him very far. I don't know where you buy white tie and tails from, but I don't think it's Superdrug, when I last checked.
Super dry.
Super
dry and
sorry, super drug. I was thinking of
For legal reasons, sorry. We should probably sorry. Specify.
Should do. Yeah, I don't give you the identity of the next big donation to the main campaign.
Yeah, super dry, then super drug, then after that, I'm not sure.
It's super something, anyway. We have all the supers on our side.
Andrew, what do you believe is Britain's most populous city? As someone who's travelled around a lot on trains.
London, by far. And it's not just Britain's most populous city, it's the world's most populous city. I mean, part of the reason why we're such a successful country is we have the most successful city in the world. Now, I love other cities too, and I spend probably longer travelling, you know, to them and visiting them than most other people who are in Parliament, partly because I love the trains. And so any excuse to get up to Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, and I can give you all the stations and everything. But let's be clear, we have the world's city in London, and we should be proud of it. We shouldn't downplay it. Brexit will, unfortunately, lead to it being on the decline, not the ascent, as it has been so powerfully over the last 20 years, including, of course, being the fourth largest French city in the world. I mean, this is
that's
not the country
that's a zombie stat, I'm afraid.
I thought it was actually
made up by Boris Johnson. We come back to Brexit. Well,
there are a lot of French here.
Apparently 350 million French people live in London.
There's 350,000, not millions.
Marie, what do you think the British public think is Britain's favourite city?
So I have seen that poll, so I can give you options. Do you want me to guess something that's like hysterically wrong and it's all very funny? Or can I pretend to guess and be like, yay?
Why don't you pretend to guess and be like, yay?
Cool. Is it York?
It is York.
Yay!
Well done. Well done. York, Bath and Edinburgh were top three in terms of British views. London, my favourite city and Andrew's favourite city, 22nd, in between Hereford, which I didn't even know was a city, and Newcastle.
In your face, Newcastle.
Newcastle definitely is a city. I can assure you of that. Newcastle definitely is. Hereford is only a city, of course, because it has a cathedral. Oh. It's like St David's.
Which is 17th, also ahead of London.
And these are very, very beautiful places, and Hereford has the Mappa Mundi. I mean, it is definitely a place to go, and it has a brilliant station, and it goes you get the train from Paddington gets there in 3 hours, and it goes through Worcester, which is another beautiful city with another
19th
cathedral.
Also ahead of London,
and it goes through Oxford. The same train goes through Oxford as well, which I imagine is quite high up
12th
too.
ahead of London,
and that also has a cathedral. So I'm not denigrating any of these places. These are all wonderful places, but none of them are world cities on
do Sunderland, Wolverhampton and Bradford have cathedrals?
Bradford certainly does, because Sunderland and Wolverhampton, I don't
because
think
they were
do.
They were bottom of the list published by YouGov, which also went on to ask people their most popular English counties. Marie, is that something you've looked over my shoulder at to get the results for?
No.
What's your favourite English county?
Is Greater London a county?
It is.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Fine. Greater London. Cool.
38th, below Hertfordshire.
Oh, come on.
It is literally below Hertfordshire, both in geographical terms and in terms of the ranking.
Shall I tell you my favourite county?
Go ahead.
And why? Surrey, because it has a higher density of railways than any other county in England.
34th.
It only has Tory MPs, but it has lots of railways and trains.
Andrew, as a life peer, I'm assuming this question has vexed you perhaps over the years. If you had the choice between owning a private plane or a private yacht,
do you know how much time I spend?
Notice railway, private railway, private railway carriage not allowed. But a private plane or a private yacht, which would you go for?
I would say, would you please give me a third way, which is a private train? Now, when I was Transport Secretary,
I think Kim Jong-il has a private train, which he handed on to his son.
When I was Transport Secretary, do you know what my most onerous responsibility was? I was guardian of the Royal Train. Now, the Royal
Did you take it home at weekends? I did go on it,
but Her Majesty wouldn't actually lend it to me. I mean, I couldn't use it for parties or anything like that. But can you imagine having her own train and being able to go around the country?
Where is the Royal Train kept?
I'm not allowed to say it's a state secret.
Oh, right, so it really is.
Oh, official secret set. Right. I would be in the tower if I told you where it's been kept.
It's in the tower?
No, I would be in the tower.
You're winking at me in that sort of
It's in a very secret location. But it is a wonderful train. It hasn't been desperately modernised. It's mostly 1970s carriages.
It's still run on steam.
Yeah, no, it has its own diesel locomotive. But I'd be very, very happy to have that, and I would certainly trade it in for a yacht or a plane.
Marie?
I like the idea of going on a yacht holiday, but also, surely you'd just go a bit mad. Like, you know, you'd like the idea of it, but I feel like the reality is just being stuck effectively in a sort of, like, you know, small flat with like three friends surrounded by the sea. Yeah, no. I feel like a yacht holiday actually would be a nightmare. So yeah, I'm going to go for the plane.
Well, actually, among the general population, yacht is the more popular. 44% versus 34% for planes. I think that shows lack of ambition, quite frankly. I'm afraid, Andrew, that train was not an option. Only 18 to 24-year-olds prioritise planes over trains. Over planes over yachts. You've got me at it now.
God, I was about to give my people, but no, I'm old
but
now.
But you know, I don't think many people spend much time worrying about these particular choices in life. Others that are a bit more pressing at the moment, like, are we going to stay in the European Union or leave it? That's far more pressing than yachts or planes.
I think if you gave the gave the people the choice between a private yacht, a private plane, or Brexit, yeah. I think most people...
A private plane, but no Brexit.
Like, yeah, that's the next question to
But
to
I want
ask.
Aaron Banks's private plane then, in the case of Brexit. I mean, if we could take all the private planes away from the Brexiters and then give
Does
them...
Does he actually have a private plane, though? Is that just something that Andy Wigmore made up?
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there isn't a private plane there somewhere. So.
He either has none or about five. We can't be sure.
Producer Nick here with a brief interruption. I'm joined now by Carl McGrath from Ladbrokes. So, Carl, we've just heard from Lord Adonis, who reckons that a second referendum on the terms of the Brexit deal is becoming ever more likely. Do Ladbrokes customers feel the same way?
I'd probably slightly disagree with that, actually, Nick. I mean, if anything, punters have been slightly apathetic in this market over the last couple of weeks. So originally, if we go back a week or two ago, the odds were 2-1 for another EU referendum before 2020. That's actually drifted slightly out to 9-4 now, probably due to recess or probably due to other things slightly more popular at the moment. But yeah, there's been a slight drift on the market, I would say.
Have you noticed a big drop-off in interest in these markets as everyone in Westminster heads on their summer holes?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely had an impact. The money we were seeing up to a couple of weeks ago was significantly higher than we've seen over the last couple of weeks. I mean, we may find that Lord Adonis is right, and in a couple of weeks the price may again plummet. But for now, I would say it's drifting slightly.
Well, it certainly feels like there are rumblings, and there has been some polling which suggested that the tide of opinion has changed in this area. Do you think that actually at 9-4, this is a bit of a value bet at the moment and it might come in the next couple of weeks?
Yes. I mean, I think I can definitely see the price coming in again. With these markets, you tend to find that the more publicity at the moment, the more the odds will drop and the more money we will see on it. I guess the other side of that argument is more down to a timescale factor. So the idea of that this has to be called, the logistics behind it, and then actually staging the referendum within less than a year and a half now would, I guess, be the reason why the odds may be drifting slightly.
And would a referendum on the terms of the Brexit deal rather than a rerun of the first referendum count towards your another UK-EU referendum market?
Yes, well, as long as it included some sort of element of a potential to stay within the EU, then yes, it would count towards it, yes.
If people have been lukewarm on that market, have they been more interested in Donald Trump and his markets, given that he is all over the press this week?
Yes, the last couple of days, it's comfortably been our most popular markets have all been related to Trump. So, for example, this morning, we've seen quite a bit of money on the odds of him leaving office via resignation or impeachment before the end of his first term. So that's come in from 5-2 to 6-4 this morning. And I'd say it's probably likely to go even shorter over the next couple of days as well, as the media really picks up on this story.
And I guess we're now looking ahead to the midterms, which will be a big event for you in your markets.
Yeah, and at the moment the Democrats are as short as 2-5 to win the midterms in November and take back the House. Again, they were, I think, as big as just below evens, so around 10-11 a few weeks back. So there's been a huge surge of interest in that market. And again, it's very likely that they may well run off even shorter if this Trump story continues to rumble on over the next few months.
In terms of scale, how does the interest from British punters in the American political markets compare to their interest in the UK? Do you think it's a sort of more niche activity?
Definitely a more niche activity. You tend to see what we describe as more shrewd business around markets such as this. So, for example, with this, with the Trump story over the last couple of days, you see quite a lot of, I guess, indirect betting on the November midterms as a sort of shrewd angle, I guess, as opposed to betting on Trump leaving this year or resigning via impeachment. You tend to get slightly more shrewd bettors who will look for different angles such as this, as opposed to sort of mass market betting like a general election.
So it's the less shrewd bettors who are going for the big Trump splashy markets. But I see that one of the big ones you're running is when will he be replaced, with a variety of different options. Is there any particular year that is catching people's fancy at the moment?
Yes, I mean, you often find with these markets that the shorter term options, so for example in this market, 2018 has been cut from 10 to 1 into 13 to 2 this morning for the year that Trump will be replaced. And 2019 is into 4 to 1 from 6 to 1. So a lot of punters, you find when these sort of stories break, will look for, I guess, an immediate payout almost, you know, and the idea that it could happen very soon. Sometimes you see the slightly more shrewd bettors looking at the longer term options. So, for example, 2021 is still very much the firm favourite at evens in this market.
Thanks, Kyle. And all of those markets are available on the Ladbrokes website or by downloading the Ladbrokes app. Now back to the guys in the studio.
And finally, I would like to discuss the, as I believe in the parlance of young people, trailer that dropped for the new BBC series Press.
News. More important than your son.
No, more important than you.
Press on BBC One.
To me, it looks like definitely the best drama to come out of the BBC in 2003. I think it's only 15 years too late. It's quite a thing. Marie, you've worked in newspapers. Andrew, you've worked in newspapers. The Press trailer suggests it's going to be a show about two fictitious papers, the Herald, which is obviously meant to be the Guardian, and the Post, which is obviously meant to be the Sun, battling it out for... who knows what?
Which is weird, because actually even the setup is weird, because actually you would never have the Guardian and the Sun are not direct competitors. You know, so the Guardian, you know, a few years ago it would have been the Independent, the Sun would be the Mail or whoever. Like, they're not, they would never be direct competitors. That's not how the Press works.
But we're not sure how that's how the programme works. We know Poirot is in it.
David Suchet is there. He's almost the only attractive bit of the entire trailer, I thought, until the arrival of the Polar Bear. I wasn't sure where the Polar Bear came into this. The Polar Bear the editor of the Guardian?
Oh, no, hang on. Wasn't it like the
The mirror dressing someone up as a chicken.
Apparently, it's always the same chicken costume. They just pass it on to the youngest member of staff.
So I mistook a chicken for a polar bear. Now that is a
no. It's a polar bear. It is a polar bear in the trailer, but perhaps they couldn't use an actual chicken costume for legal reasons. It's definitely quite a thing.
Do you know what I slightly worry about is that there's nothing that the media love doing media programmes about and dramas and all that than other bits of the media. I'm not sure how turned on, unless it's done very well, I'm not sure how turned on Joe Public is going to be about a BBC series about two newspapers slogging it out between them.
15 years after that was a relevant story.
I think Swedish noir, that has a bit of a wider clientele myself.
I agree. I think it's a really interesting decision. I remember State of Play, which was
good.
Fantastic series. Dreadful film, fantastic series from the BBC. But that wasn't really about newspapers; that was just set in newspapers. And of course, Drop the Dead Donkey, a comedy from my youth, which I absolutely loved. But that was a comedy. This doesn't look deliberately funny, though by chance there are funny lines in the trailers. It's certainly something.
That's what I didn't get, because I feel like Americans are quite bad with that normally, but the UK is normally okay. It's the fact that working in a newsroom is mostly kind of like absurd comedy. Like, a lot of it is just going to be black humour, kind of pointless intrigue and drama, and just people go, like, incredibly neurotic people going a bit mad. That's a comedy. That's got comedy written all over it, not sort of like poncy drama about the meaning of the truth and... we never talk about that. I've been a journalist for 5 years. I have not had one conversation about, you know, our job is the truth.
and on that note, Andrew, thank you very much for letting us into your office and for talking to us today.
And I just need to give a final plug for my book, Saving Britain, all good bookshops, less than the £9, and it gives you the manifesto as to why we should stop Brexit and stay in the EU.
The book is Saving Britain, and We Must Change to Prosper in Europe, available at all good bookshops where you buy these types of things. I'm afraid there was no time for our interview with Jacob Rees-Mogg wearing his super dry hat, even though he appears to be moving in the building next door, which is a scoop for us all. Just a quick look at our reviews on Twitter this week. Okay, thank you very much. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled PODOTPODS.com.